Now would perhaps be a good time for Fiona to come and talk to you, because the afternoon actually is whizzing past. So I'm not sure, Fiona, how many of you know Fiona for herself, or how many of you know her because of Roy Castle? I mean, many of us have grew up with Roy Castle, didn't we? And I can still, whenever I mention his name, I see his smiling face and remember him, his performances that we enjoyed so much on the TV. So it's a huge privilege for us to have Fiona with us. And I'll just hand over to her.
That's fine. Oh. Thank you. Thank you. That's applause before I've even said a word. That's amazing. My husband would have said, I think I'll finish on that and leave. Well, I've told Carol that my story is so long that it'll probably take about 3.5 hours, so you'll be ready for coffee by then, won't you? Anyway, it's lovely to be here and to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit about my life, as well as my life with Roy, and perhaps how we got together. Obviously, from what you've nodded and mentioned, you all knew Roy, and probably some of the younger ones amongst you will have grown up with record breakers and tried to break your own records, as a lot of the young people did in those days. But I met him way, way back before that, because he was an entertainer. He was able to play all sorts of instruments. In fact, he broke a record on record breakers. I think he played 43 instruments in 3 minutes or something ridiculous. Some of them were like the kitchen sink and cymbals and silly things like that. But he was totally self-taught, apart from tap dancing. And when he was a very small child, his mother sent him to tap dancing lessons because, as he said to me, his knees were the thickest part of his legs. And he said, his mother said, "Up and they'll thicken your legs up, lad." So he went to tap dancing lessons, and that was the only thing he did where he was actually taught. The rest of it was he was self-taught. All the instruments he learned, he taught himself, and so on. But anyway, I came on the scene once he was well known. But before that, in my life and my career, I started dancing at the age of 5. I just went to a little school. I came from a place called West Kirby, which is on the Wirral near Liverpool. And when I say West Kirby, people say, "Oh, that's the posh part of Liverpool." We never thought it was very posh. But anyway, that my father was a doctor in that area. But when I went to this little dancing class at my school, the dancing teacher came to my mother one day and said, "She shows promise." Do you remember that expression? "She shows promise." So my mother got really excited about it and thought, "Well, what can I do?" And so she and my dancing teacher had a long discussion about how I could become a dancer or take it more seriously. And the upshot was that my parents sent me to a boarding school 250 miles away in a place called Camberley in Surrey from the age of 9. Now, they sacrificed a lot in order to send me there, and I have to say I loved every minute of it. It was wonderful. You might think, "Oh, 9 years old, I've got grandchildren older than that, and I still think, how could my mother have let me go?" She's probably quite glad, actually. I enjoyed the experience. It was not just ballet, it was all sorts of dance and theatre, singing and all the rest of it. When I was 16, I realised I was never going to be a ballet dancer, and I was never going to get into a ballet company, which was a great disappointment to me, because I would love to be able to tell you I was a ballerina. But you never heard of me, did you? I never got good enough to get into a ballet company. But in those days, if that was the case, the next best thing was to go to learn your trade, as it were, in pantomimes and summer seasons. And for the young ones amongst you, summer seasons were variety shows that functioned all round the coast of Great Britain in the summer. And the very first pantomime I did after I left school was actually not a million miles away from here. It was the Coventry Hippodrome. And it was the longest running pantomime in the country. Can you believe it went on till April? But Top of the bill was Harry Secombe. Second on the bill were Morecambe and Wise. Ooh, I thought I'd get your attention now. Suddenly, you're interested, aren't you? Well, it was before Eric and Ernie had really made a name for themselves on television, although they were incredibly talented and everybody loved them. But I got to know Eric and Joan, his wife, very well. And they were very good to me. They knew I was a starving dancer. So they occasionally used to invite me to their home at weekends. They'd feed me up and then they'd give me all the leftovers so I didn't starve for the rest of the week. They were very, very kind to me, I have to say, in those days. And so that was how my career started, and it was a very inauspicious career. I didn't do anything amazing. I did graduate from chorus to principal girl in pantomime and what they called soubrette in summer season, which is where you dance and you sing and you do the comedy with the comedians in the cast and so on. And then I did various musicals, ending up in one that I normally don't tell people about, but actually it's become quite fashionable again, because I was in the original cast of The Sound of Music. I was so young that I was able to sing, I am 16, going on 72 in those days. Anyway, I understudied the part of Liesl and then took over because the original one left to get married, and then I left to get married. But that's another story, because it was one of the weekends when I was staying with Eric and Joan that Roy happened to come on the television. And I'd seen him in the Palladium pantomime, and I thought he was absolutely brilliant. He'd just sort of become well known, even though he started in show business at the age of 8 with a tiny little show, a little amateur show. The show got so good that by the time he was 14, the whole show went professional and he left school. So he was working at his trade, as it were, from the age of 8. But he didn't get well known until he was about 27 or something like that. And that was through a Royal Variety performance. And he was busy sort of telling jokes and things, and nobody was taking a lot of notice until suddenly Prince Philip laughed at one of his jokes, and everybody looked up into the royal box and started laughing. And that's how he made his name. He always says he owed his career to Prince Philip. We were watching Roy on television that evening when I was staying with Eric and Joan. And I just said to Eric, oh, I think Roy Castle's absolutely brilliant. If ever you do a show with him, can I come along so that you can introduce me? I'd love to meet him. He's so talented. So he just said, right, love. End of story. I thought, oh, well, that's not going to happen. But it did. Quite a lot later. By that time, I was working in The Sound of Music, and Eric and Ernie were doing a pantomime doing a summer season, I think, at the Palladium. And Eric rang me one day and said, hey, I'm doing a television with Roy at the weekend. Do you want to come along? Oh, yes, please, I said. So off I went with Joan, Eric's wife. Just before the show started, Eric took me into Roy's dressing room to introduce me. I thought it was going to be the best moment of my life, but it turned out to be the very worst. Because he just said, Roy, this is Fiona, she's in love with you, and left. That's a typical Eric remark, isn't it? You know, you can trust him to do something like that. He always did the unexpected. Left me blushing up to the roots of my then blonde hair, wanting to die. And Roy was very shy and he couldn't think of anything to say after that. So we just looked at each other like idiots. Anyway, we all went out for a meal afterwards. It got a little bit better after that. What I didn't discover till Roy knew me well enough to tell me was that Eric had said to him earlier that day, look, Roy, I've got this little fan coming to see you. She's quite a sad creature. She's got braces on her teeth and pigtails, but be nice to her, will you? So, it wasn't a very good introduction one way or another. Anyway, things got a bit better and we were married a year later, at which point I gave up my career, because at that time Roy was doing very well in the United States. He was doing a lot of television and various shows over there. And I thought, well, if we've got the Atlantic separating us, there's not much point us getting married. So I was very happy to be able to travel with Roy, going to places I'd only ever seen on maps. I'd never had the opportunity or the money to travel anywhere. So it was absolutely brilliant for me. And for 2 years, we pretty much lived out of a suitcase, going back and forth. And it was fantastic. And then after 2 years, our first child was born. And even when he was born, at that time, Roy was working in the United States with Harry Secombe in a show called Pickwick. I don't know if any of you ever remember that one. And so he was touring around, and I had to take this new baby all on my own. And I thought I'd never keep him alive, you know, even on the aeroplane. You know how worried you are about your first baby. Everything's a big deal for you. Anyway, he did survive, amazingly. And I went on to have 3 more children. Of course, they thrive on neglect, don't they? You know, you're not nearly so worried about your other children because you've done it once before. The poor first one is the experiment the whole way through his life. I think he's still suffering from that, even though he's 46 now. But anyway, obviously there came a time when the children had to go to school. And then I realized that I had to stay at home. We'd actually made a decision before we had children that I would always be there to be the anchor, the mum for the children. Roy would travel when he had to and come back when he could. I was very aware of the hazards of show business, and I knew that it would cause separation from time to time. So that was, in itself, it was fine. But in reality, it began to be quite different. I took my job very seriously. I loved being a mom. I loved being a hostess. I loved being a homemaker. So that wasn't a problem to me. I was far happier to be at home, actually. But when I was at home most of the time, and my husband was away most of the time, the responsibility weighed very heavily on me. And I began to feel quite isolated and down. One of the reasons I felt down and low in my spirit was because I had this terrible condition, and I don't know if anybody suffers from it. You don't have to put your hands up. But I was a perfectionist. Do you know what it means to be a perfectionist? You're nodding, so I know who you are now. You shouldn't give yourselves away. The trouble with being a perfectionist is that you're always a failure. Do you realize that? Because you never match up to your own expectation of what that perfection should be. And I was always struggling and striving to be this perfect wife, mother, homemaker, hostess, whatever it took. But I always felt that I didn't match up. I wanted to please Roy. I wanted to please other people. I wanted to do things so that people said, "Isn't she amazing?" But nobody ever did. But the other thing was that I would see other young mums doing the things I was really struggling to do well and not having a care in the world about it. It was so easy for them. Why was it so difficult for me? Why was I so screwed up about it? And why wasn't it working for me? I wonder if you realize, well, maybe it hasn't happened to you, but it's so easy to look at other people's strengths and see your own weaknesses. You see other people doing the things that you long to be able to do and you can't do them, and you just feel as if you're no good. I would be wanting to really impress people by inviting them for a meal. Why is it that when you go to other people's homes, everything gets cooked at the right time? But when people came to me, that didn't happen. Or a story that Roy used to love to tell, to my shame and embarrassment, about how we had this big Christmas party at one time, and I decided I'd make this wonderful chocolate cheesecake. It was a recipe that had been given to me by my neighbor. I tasted it and I thought, this is fantastic, I must do it for Christmas, it'll be wonderful. And Roy told the story about how I made this cake, and it looked fantastic, full of really wonderful ingredients. He said the only trouble was that as the guests put the first spoonful in their mouths, the spoon stuck to the roof of their mouths and they couldn't get it out. And he said we ended up having to have cheese and biscuits. And he said we put it out to the birds and even they hadn't managed to eat it by February. Talk about making me blush. But that was me. Why couldn't my cheesecake taste the same as my neighbour's? She'd given me the recipe. It didn't work. That all added to the fact that I felt that I was rubbish. Or, you know, you go to somebody's house and everything is neat and tidy and colour coordinated down to the last smelly candle. Have you been there? And white carpets, so you immediately get so nervous you spill your coffee. And you think, oh, I can't ask them back to my house because it's a mess. I've still got furniture that my great aunt left me because we couldn't afford anything else at the time and it's still there. And I know that this happens today, that people feel they can't invite their neighbours because their home doesn't match up. So what do? They go and get into debt to pay for new stuff to make them feel better about themselves. We're constantly reminded, much more today than when I was a young mum, about how we should have stuff because of all the makeover programs that are on the television. And what do? They only make us feel dissatisfied with ourselves, don't they? Whether it's our homes or our gardens or our fashion or our hair or our faces or our bodies, whatever it might be. And it makes us feel, oh dear, we don't match up, we're not good enough, we better put this cream on that cream. I have to tell you a funny story about that. I turned 70 at the beginning of last year, and this friend of mine, she's a really close friend, she's always teased me all through our lives that she's 3 months younger than I am. And so she gave me a t-shirt on my 70th birthday, and right across the front it said, "It's taken me 70 years to look this good." So I had the courage to wear it at my next Keep Fit class, thinking everybody will think, yes, isn't she fit for 70? And this woman, who's come to the same class as me for a long, long time, she came and she pointed at it. She said, "Oh, I thought you were 80. She said, "I thought you were doing pretty good for your age." So I went home and I threw all of my anti-wrinkle creams in the dustbin. I thought, well, they haven't worked, why should I worry? But you know what I love? I love the laughter that created. Because why do we worry so much? It's not going to make any difference at the end of our lives, is it? Do you remember a comedian called Bill Cosby? He had a television program, it must be 20-something years ago. And at that time, it was when plastic surgery was just getting big in America. And he was deriding it and saying how ridiculous it all was and so on. And he said, "There's a woman I've known for 25 years who now looks nothing like the woman she was 3 months ago." And he goes on to say all the things that she'd had taken out and put in and all the rest of it. And he ended up by saying, "What's the point of having a beautiful face on a 73-year-old body that can't bend over?" I love that. I love it because there's no way we won't notice. That made me feel much better about my wrinkles. Anyway, I'm joking, but actually, at that particular time, I was in my mid-30s. I got to the stage where I just thought, oh, I don't know how to cope. I can't cope any longer. I really wanted to be a good wife to Roy, as I said, so that he could be proud of me. But actually it was having the opposite effect, because I was so low in my spirit that whatever he said or did, it didn't work for me. And I tried all sorts of things to get better, to make myself feel better, but nothing worked. I always came back to this place of failure. And one day I thought, I can't go on like this any longer. And I went up to my bedroom after I'd taken the children to school, and I just cried out to God, got down on my knees, and I said, "God, if you're there, you've got to help me, and you've got to help me now, because I've had it. I can't go on like this any longer." That's all I said, and I don't honestly think I expected God to hear me, let alone do anything about it in the state I was in. And I was beginning to wonder if it was all a load of rubbish and he was a figment of everybody's imagination. But God must have known I meant business that day, because before I'd even got up off my knees, the phone rang. When I picked the phone up, The person who was at the other end was a woman I knew very slightly. I'd met her a couple of times, would never have expected her to phone me socially, but I did know she was a Christian. And she just said, "Fiona, I don't know why I'm phoning you, but I've had you on my mind recently, and I had this sudden urge to ring you." She said, "I feel as if you need to talk. I don't know why, and I don't know what you need to talk about, but would you like to come over and have a coffee with me, and we can talk?" Well, I recognize that as God's way of answering that desperate cry for help. So I went round to her house then and there. I dumped Benjamin, our baby, who was about 14 months old, into Roy's arms, and I said, "I'm going out," and I left. He told me later he thought I'd literally left him holding the baby and I'd gone for good. He was probably quite relieved about it at the time because of the way I'd been behaving, but anyway, off I went. I think because I didn't know this woman very well, it was much easier to talk to her. I was far too proud ever to tell my family or my friends how I was really feeling. Do you know, very often it's easier to put a mask in front of your face with a smile, and that's what I did all the time. Had a mask with a smile, pretending all was well. Now, just to interrupt a little bit, how many people today came in to this lovely room and said, "Hello, how are you?" And what was your answer? "Fine." You've got that mask. I expect some of you had masks. Why? Partly because sometimes it's easier to keep people at arm's length. We have a little sort of box around us so that people don't really know the real us that's going on inside. And partly because we realize they don't want to know the real answer anyway. They couldn't be bothered to listen to all your woes and problems. And so you just say, "Fine." And that's how I was. I would pretend nobody knew what was really going on inside me. Because let's face it, I was probably one of the most privileged people that you could have imagined. I had a husband who loved me and provided for me. I didn't have to work outside the home in order to help to pay a mortgage. I had four beautiful, healthy children. I had a lovely home with everything in it to make life comfortable. What more could anybody want? But you see, that was all on the outside. Just like my wrinkles, they're on the outside. But inside, I was falling apart and nobody could see that. So I dumped on this lady because I didn't know her very well and I knew she wouldn't be able to tell my friends. And she was a very good listener and she heard me out. And then she asked me the most challenging question anybody's ever asked me in my life. She simply said, "You know, Fiona, you think you're a Christian because you go to church, but have you ever invited Jesus to come in and take over your life?" To which I had to say, "No, I haven't. I didn't realize you were supposed to. As far as I was aware, that wasn't in the Book of Common Prayer. You know, as far as I was aware, I had to live a good life. I had a finger-wagging God who was telling me I was not good enough to get to heaven unless I did all the right things and ticked all the boxes. And I just thought that that was it. I said my prayers, I went to church, had the children christened, I did the things that I was supposed to do." And she was saying, "Had I invited Jesus into my life?" So when I said no, she said, "Well, don't you think it's about time you did?" And at that point I just said yes, and I only said yes because I was afraid to say no. I didn't know what to do and I didn't know what it would mean. But I thought I might have to become one of these cranky people, you know, that I'd heard about. But she told me that she'd suffered from depression for many years, and that when she took that step, it totally turned her life around. And I thought, well, if it's worked for her, it could work for me. I would have tried anything that day if I felt that it was going to make life better for me, my marriage, and my family. And I'm so grateful to God that it was He who intervened by causing that woman to phone me that day. She then read a verse from the Bible to me. And I'm sure even if you've never opened a Bible in your life, you'll know the verse that I'm going to refer to because it has a very famous painting that goes with it. The verse is this: "Look, I am standing at the door and I am constantly knocking. If anyone hears me calling him and opens the door, I will come in and enjoy fellowship with him and he with me. And I realized that Jesus had been knocking at the door of my heart for 35 years, and I'd never let him in because I didn't realize I was supposed to. So that day I opened the door of my heart to Jesus and I invited him in. With her help, because I wasn't very good at praying without the use of a prayer book, I prayed a prayer that went something like this. Please, Jesus, forgive me for the mess I've made of my life, my marriage, my family. I recognize that the way I've been trying to run my life hasn't worked. So you come in, into my heart, take over my life, and see what you can do with the rest of it, okay? Simple as that. And I can only say at that very moment he did. I didn't suddenly see visions or hear voices or anything like that, but I just experienced peace that I never knew was possible. It was like all the tension, anxiety, fear just seemed to melt away, and in place of it came this incredible peace. It's like somebody pouring healing oil all over me and right through me, touching all the hurting places of my life. And I knew I was different. I wasn't quite sure how it would work out in reality from day to day at that point, but I just trusted God. I went home to face the same problems, the same situations that I'd faced an hour or so before. None of those things changed, but God changed my attitude to all of those things, began to change my mind, helped me to see life from his point of view rather than the chaos of my own point of view. God also very amazingly spoke to me so clearly on the way home as I was driving back home, telling me that I should not tell Roy what had happened. Can you imagine if I'd gone home and said, "It's all right now, darling, I've become a Christian, so everything will be fine." He'd have gone, "Oh, she's got religious mania on top of it," and he probably would have done a runner, and that would have been the end of it. But God showed me I had to live out what I'd discovered by being different, not just telling him I was different. So I was very quiet, didn't say a word. But he said, as I came into the house, it was as if somebody had painted our house in 2 seconds flat, that I'd gone out, it was all dark and gloomy, and I'd come back in and it was all light and bright and sunny. But he thought it might just be a 5-minute wonder, so he didn't ask. He said, "I'll wait and see." And after a few weeks of me being tested, I suppose, he started to ask me what had happened. "Where did you go that day? And who did you speak to? And what's happened to you? And why are you being nice to me?" Things like that. So when I told him, his answer was classic. He just said, "Oh, thank goodness." He said, "I've been praying for years you'd see the light and become a reasonable human being again." So I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg. But anyway, I have to say that from that moment onwards, our marriage changed totally. My attitude to my family changed totally. I was far more consistent, less panicky, less anxious and all the rest of it. And I just knew that God was the person I had to please, not other people. And the amazing thing was that he showed me that I should give up all the things I was doing outside the home, which was the stuff that I was doing to try and please God by being involved with all sorts of charities and this and that, and just focus on being the wife and the mother he called me to be at that time. It was so simple. And I was able in that time to make up for the mess I'd made of it up to that point. And just knew peace. Not worried about what other people thought of me. How many of us so worry so much about what, oh, wonder what she'll think if I do that, oh dear. We're worried about what other people think of us, aren't we? Roy had a lovely expression. He said, from 20 to 30, we worry about what people think of us. From 30 to 40, we don't worry quite so much. And from 40 onwards, we realize that they weren't thinking about us anyway. And I think it's probably quite true, isn't it? We're far too wrapped up in our own problems to worry about what other people are getting up to. So life totally was transformed for me, and I was very, very privileged to have a really happy marriage. It was the 25th of February 1975. That was the day I was born, or born again. It was my birthday. It was the best day of my life. And you know, that peace that he gave me that day has never left me. So long as I'm doing what he wants me to do, being where he wants me to be, that's my place of peace. And I've just known that ever since. And the lovely thing about that peace is that it's not dependent on circumstances. It's easy to have peace, isn't it, when everything's okay, you haven't got a care in the world, maybe you're lying on a beach with the sun shining down. It's a different thing to know that peace when your world is falling apart. But that was the peace that Jesus gave me. My peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives do I give to you. So do not be troubled or afraid. Those were his words. He also said, in the world you will have trouble, but be of good courage, because I've overcome the world. So my life was not exempt from problems once I became a Christian, but I just knew I could trust him whatever happened. And that was the difference. I didn't need to be anxious for what happened, because I knew that I was in his hands and he was in control. And that makes such a difference. And up to that point, as I said, I'd experienced Christianity as a ritual and a religion, but not a reality or a relationship. It was all dependent on how good I was, and I never matched up. Now I realize it was something completely different, and that nobody is outside the love of Jesus if we are willing to come to him. Well, I know I haven't got time to go into it in detail, but Roy died in 1994. It was a huge shock when he was told that he had lung cancer, in 1992, and he was only given 3 months to live. He actually lived 2.5 years in reality. But all the time we just knew that we had to allow God to use the circumstances that we found ourselves in at that time. That's all God was asking of us. And so we just let go and put the whole thing into his hands and allowed him to work through what we were going through, and obviously particularly what Roy was going through. Now, I told you that, well, you gathered from my accent that his mother had, that he was from Yorkshire. He used to describe himself as an ordinary, down-to-earth little Yorkshireman, and he was right on all those counts, including the little, because he wasn't very tall. But the reason I say that is because towards the end of his life, in the last week or so before he died, he began to have the most wonderful glimpses of heaven that were making him not just peaceful about dying, but excited about dying. Can you believe that? He saw himself in this wonderful garden, and he started to try to describe it to me, but he said it was more beautiful than anything he'd ever seen on earth. And so it was impossible to describe, and he said, I thought I was a gardener, but this gardener, something else. He said, don't hang around, darling, you need to see this as well. I would have gone if I could have seen it. But the very last time the pastor of our church came to give him communion at his bedside, there were just the three of us in the room. And then Roy sat up and said, Jesus is standing in the doorway, can you see him? And I just knew that he was preparing Roy for what lay ahead, gave him the assurance of his eternal destination, and also the assurance, the reassurance for me. Not because we're good enough, because we're not, but because he has paid the price for us through what he did at Calvary. He satisfied God's anger against my sin so that I could know the assurance of eternal life once I'd received him and accepted him as Lord and Saviour. Jesus said, come to me, all you who work so hard beneath such a heavy load, and I will give you rest. Now that rest isn't, I'll pop you into bed with a hot water bottle and pull the duvet over you, sing you a lullaby and you can go to sleep. It's not that sort of rest at all. It's rest within your spirit. It's that peace that only he can give in all circumstances. Come to me. It's an invitation. Nobody's beyond being able to accept that invitation. Has you everybody's name on the top, like every good invitation. But that's when choice comes into it, because it also has RSVP on the bottom. And we're free to choose to accept or reject anything that he's said. Now, just before I finish, I want to say, would I be bothered 36 years later to stand up and tell you about it if it wasn't still real in my heart? I'm not one who likes standing up in public. That was Roy's job. I was the one with the rubber gloves on doing the washing up, waving him goodbye at the window. There's a lot about Christianity, about the Bible, about the story of Jesus that I don't understand. But I believe it with all my heart, because God changed my life that day and continues to do so right through to today. Come to me, all you who work so hard beneath such a heavy load, and I will give you rest. The choice is yours, and the rest is up to you. Thank you.